up on KUCB News, a new strain of COVID-19 has arrived in Alaska, and a federal fisheries council eliminated the seat of one of its Alaska Native panel members. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Maggie Nelson with some local news on Thursday, April 8th, 2021. At the end of last year, the council that regulates Alaska's lucrative federal fisheries downsized a key advisory panel that gives input on management. The reorganization eliminated two representatives, one of whom, supporters say, had been an effective advocate for Alaska Natives and smaller vessels in the industry. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council often flies under the radar, meeting in dimly lit conference rooms and delving into technical questions about fish stocks and ecosystems. But it has a hugely important job: conservation of species and managing offshore fisheries for species like cod, pollock, and crab, which are huge economic drivers for coastal communities on the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska. At the end of last year, the council went into a closed-door meeting. When it emerged, it had eliminated two seats on a key advisory panel, one of which was held by Alaska Native member Natasha Hayden of Kodiak, who was seeking reappointment. That decision to eliminate Hayden from the panel upset many stakeholders, especially those advocating for Indigenous voices in fisheries management.
This is a time when we should be adding more Indigenous voices to council bodies and not less.
That's St. Paul Island attorney Marissa Merkuliev testifying 2 months later to the full council. She works for the St. Paul Island tribal government, which runs affairs for the small Pribilof Island community in the Bering Sea. St. Paul's tribal government representatives, like Conservation Director Lauren Devine, say they lost a key ally with Hayden's departure.
And it was a huge loss for Indigenous communities, Indigenous voices in the council process, and that's why there was so much outrage at a time when, you know, we really were hoping that the council would hop onto the racial equity movement.
She says Native communities already are underrepresented in fisheries management, and that's a problem because the health and management of fish stocks are a big deal for communities that rely on commercial fishing and subsistence. Hayden was born and raised in Kodiak. She's from an Indigenous Aleutic family and the daughter of a commercial fisherman. Now, she and her husband own a commercial fishing boat. As vice president of Lands and Natural Resources of the Afognak Native Corporation, she told KUCB she was well qualified.
We are, you know, actively participating in federal fisheries. I'm a civil engineer. I'm elected tribal member. Like, what else do you have to do to be considered worthy to participate in the process?
The blowback of her ouster was intense. In February, the Fishery Management Council received more than 20 letters calling for her reappointment. Alaska Marine Conservation Council's Teresa Peterson was among them.
I'm just kind of reminded of that saying, it's never too late to do the right thing.
Longtime observers say it's not unusual for the council to adjust the number of seats on its advisory panel, and the council generally makes these types of decisions over appointments behind closed doors. But Heather McCarty, who works government affairs for a Bering Sea fisherman's nonprofit, says the council's removal of Hayden didn't add up.
Normally, unless people have been sort of obviously incompetent or inappropriate or absent or whatever, normally those reappointments are without issue. There's no, you know, there's no reason to remove somebody if they wanted to have another 3 years.
She wouldn't speculate why the council eliminated Hayden's seat, but she says it owes the public some explanation. That hasn't happened. KUCB reached out to all Alaska-based voting council members, as well as state fish and game officials who oversee Alaska's representatives. None would speak publicly about Hayden's removal, and neither would the council's full-time executive director. That silence and gaps in understanding leave others to fill the void with speculation. Critics say that some of the big corporate players in Alaska's federal fisheries can often drown out the perspectives of smaller members of the fleet. Advisory panel member Julie Kavanaugh, also of Kodiak, says Hayden was a well-balanced representative. She had been an effective advocate for Alaska natives as well as smaller fishing boats, those less than 60 feet. But Kavanaugh also noted that there were several other small boat operators on the panel.
Natasha was one of four people that own and or operate a vessel that is in that 60-foot and under class. And I think that that was a really easy thing to pick out and highlight as being repetitive on the AP and gave credence to maybe not reappointing her.
Brian Ritchie of Homer, a newcomer to the panel, says he doesn't think her removal had to do with race or politics. There are still 11 Alaskans on the 20-member panel, which oversees species that also make up parts of Oregon and Washington fisheries.
I don't think that this is an instance of systemic racism. I think that fisheries in Alaska are very nuanced, and I don't think that the council has currently or in the future, any plans to limit Indigenous representation or opportunities.
The council itself, unlike at least one other management council outside of Alaska, doesn't have a designated tribal seat. But it has recently begun outreach efforts to improve communication with rural and Alaska Native populations. But because sitting council members refuse to say why they eliminated Hayden's seat, she says she can't give them the benefit of the doubt.
If they truly wanted to have equitable participation by Alaskan Native people, they wouldn't have eliminated me.
The newly constituted advisory panel held its first meeting in February and met again this month. And while at least two Alaska Natives remain on the 20-member advisory panel, none represent tribal governments, Native nonprofits, or village corporations. Meanwhile, Alaska health officials have announced the state's first case of a mutant strain of COVID-19 first detected in South Africa. The new strain, known as B1351, both spreads more easily and appears to be somewhat resistant to vaccines. A single case was detected last month in the Anchorage-Matsu area, but state officials say that more cases are likely circulating in Alaska because the infected person had not traveled recently. That suggests they caught it from someone else in the state. Cases of new mutant strains of COVID-19 are rising sharply in the U.S., and experts warn that they could prolong the pandemic because they're more contagious and better at evading vaccines. Alaska officials have convened a group of scientists to do the complex laboratory sequencing work needed to detect the new strains, with an ambitious goal of 300 samples a week. But a series of logistical problems, including supply shortages, thwarted the effort over the past month, and state officials went several weeks without publicly reporting any new variant cases. Jamie Parker heads the state's public health labs, and she says part of the problem was that a huge grant of federal testing money meant that Alaska was competing with other states.
It just was sort of a perfect storm to not be able to purchase those supplies. And then once we purchased them, the vendor was also getting hit with every state trying to purchase these same supplies with that same funding. And so you just kind of had to get in queue and wait for your turn.
In a report released Tuesday, the state also said it detected 5 new cases last month of a different, more contagious strain of COVID-19, first found in Britain, known as B117. Parker, the state lab official, says the sequencing obstacles have been sorted out and that 300 samples a week should be doable in the future. The pandemic has driven a boom in the world of Indigenous earring makers in Alaska, connecting Northern artists via Instagram with customers around the world and with each other. In Anchorage, Alice Kanique Glenn has more.
A year ago, as the pandemic drove everybody inside, Delaney Thiel turned her focus to making earrings. She's Denina Athabaskan and Yupik from Anchorage, and she's the creator of a business called Cloudberry, selling Indigenous beaded earrings, mostly on Instagram.
I just had such a good time just like beading and doing like all of these fun designs, and most of them I never sold or like it never came to anything, but it was so fun to like explore that side of things.
Soon, things started picking up, way more than she expected. Her social media following doubled. She had her biggest sale during the holidays last December, and she said she discovered a burgeoning community of artists creating throughout the pandemic.
I'm like blonde-haired, blue eyes, very pale skin. native girl that doesn't look native. And so I think Cloudberry is just kind of like an expression of that. And it was just so influential in like me trying to figure out who I am as an Indigenous person. And so I guess I try to like reflect that in my beadwork.
Thiel is among a number of Alaska Native earring artists who have found sudden success in pandemic times. Beaded earrings have always been a staple in Native fashion, but some say they've recently become in demand more broadly. It helps that they are a quick and stylish way to show up to Zoom meetings. For the artists themselves, making and sharing the earrings is also a way to connect to community and identity and culture. For Lisa Apengaluk, who is most known for being an ivory carving artist, the last year has been up and down. Before the pandemic, her jewelry business was already growing, but the pandemic supercharged demand. As soon as she posted pictures to her social media, customers snatched up her earrings in seconds. There were complications, too. For one thing, she got COVID, which brought her work and sales to a complete halt for at least 2 weeks. On top of that, the demand of her pieces prompted others to copy her signature pieces.
So for someone to have reached out to my followers and say, yeah, I can make that for cheaper, that felt a little dirty and violating to my work.
She said she's learning to roll with the setbacks that come with increased popularity, and business continues to grow. Kavahine Danner is an Inupiaq and Hawaiian artist and jewelry maker based out of Utqiagvik. She recently moved from Hawaii and used art to cope during her relocation. She used to sell in person with her business Kavahine Creations, but the pandemic canceled that. She found a robust market online, but being rural, there are special complications.
When we run out of supplies, we don't have a Walmart or a Michaels or a huge store to go to down the street. We have to order our supplies, wait a month, and shut down our shop for that month. Another issue is our internet bills for conducting online sales are like $300 to $800 a month.
Despite the expenses, social media is an essential connector, making the earrings she crafts in a 5,000-person community on the Arctic Ocean accessible to a wider global market.
I have been able to sell earrings and prints to different, you know, all across the world, which is super cool. I get orders from everywhere, Australia, different countries, and it's been a process learning how to make a living this way, but it's been awesome. It's been exciting.
Although the pandemic has brought on unique challenges for many, all three artists feel that it has helped them grow their online businesses. They say they look forward to creating quality work and supporting any other budding artists throughout the rest of the year. In Anchorage, I'm Alice Kanik-Glenn.
Veterinarian Dr. Caldwell and his staff will be back in Unalaska starting on Saturday. The clinic will take place at the Unalaska United Methodist Church from April 10th to 16th. Church programs and services will pause for a week, and the church will not be taking donations over the course of the vet clinic. If you would like to make an appointment, call or text 359-1876. Again, that's 359-1876. And April is National Poetry Month. Stay tuned after the newscast and throughout the day to hear Unalaskans reading some of their favorite poetry. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Maggie Nelson, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. And please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts. Thank you.